You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Good afternoon. This is Dori Francis with Every Voice Matters. And I'm going to have you say hi to Aspen today, my service dog, because we are actually going to be talking about service dogs, emotional support dogs, therapy dogs. Our guest today is Molly Baker, and she is the owner of Molly Dogs Training. She's been working with dogs for about 12 years, and she's been training service dogs for about 8 years. And Molly is located in, is it Draper, Utah?
Orem,
Utah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And she specializes in assisting disabled individuals in training their own service dogs. We were just talking before the show. I have a lot of questions that were submitted for today's show. I'm not sure we'll get through all of them. We may have to have Molly come back again, but we'll certainly get through just as many as we can. Molly, let's start off with just kind of a basic, you know, what's the difference between a service dog, an emotional support dog, and a therapy dog?
Yeah, this is a really good place to start because, like, the number of times I hear people use these terms interchangeably is crazy. So a service dog, this is a dog that is tasked or work trained to assist a disabled individual. So it's a dog that works for one single person, and they're trained to assist and mitigate with whatever their disability has. So, like, a big one that I've had people not understand is, like, if you do not have a disability, you don't qualify for a service dog. But, like, I knew someone that, like, they had a fully trained seizure alert dog, but they didn't have seizures. So that's not a service dog, you know? So it's like, even if you have a fully trained service dog, if you do not have a disability, it doesn't matter. It's not a service dog as long as it's with you. Service dogs have the most access rights. So basically, individuals with disabilities have public access rights, where basically anywhere the general public is allowed, that dog is allowed to go with them, as long as they are meeting kind of a general set of behavioral standards. If they're not kind of meeting some core basic behavioral standards, it doesn't matter if they're a legitimate service dog or not. The business can ask that the dog be removed.
Yeah, they need to be well behaved.
Yeah. Actually, I had, so this was a really new client, and the first time I did a session with her, she had a patch on her dog's vest that said, access required, no exceptions, and I'm like, that's not actually true,
right?
You know, I'm like, there's actually quite a few reasons, like anything that's health or safety reason, they can deny access to your dog. Yeah. If your dog is not under your control, you know, like, I actually had a day, I was at the mall, and there was someone who had a dog that just was on this leash all over the place, like wandering clear out to the heck of the side of her. She was not paying attention. This dog was sniffing people's bags, sniffing people, like, you know, it was a small dog. So having the leash go clear out from her, I'm like, someone's not paying attention. That could be a tripping hazard.
Yes.
I went and complained. I was like, you know, I was there with a service dog and I'm like, that person
That's
is not appropriate,
right.
You know? It doesn't matter that the dog, you know, the dog is quiet and it's not, you know, like aggressive or anything like that. But that doesn't, you know, there's a lot more reasons that, you know, if your dog is not under control or that sort of thing, you know, they shouldn't be there. But that's kind of your gist of a service dog. An emotional support animal, it's basically a glorified pet. You have to have like a doctor or psychiatrist letter, basically recommending one, saying that, you know, they believe that your mental health will benefit from having one. The only access rights that they have is, in most situations where housing typically denies pets, they have to make a reasonable accommodation. In very, very, very rare circumstances, you can get a reasonable accommodation to take an ESA and to work with you. It's really rare, and that dog pretty much has to have service dog level behavioral standards, but, you know, I have heard of those situations happening. But other than that, like, you can't take an ESA out in public. I mean, basically, they're there just to kind of
they're
make
there
you
for
feel
you.
Better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, you know, so like with a
psych- panic attacks or something. Yeah.
So like a psychiatric service dog, for example, if you start having a panic attack, this dog would be trained to do pressure therapy, some kind of grounding. They can go and get emergency med bags and bring it back to you. They can go and get help if you need and bring it back to you. So they're task trained to do something to assist with that panic attack. An emotional support animal would just be, you know, come in my lap and I'm going to love you and cuddle you, and that makes me feel better. You know, so because there's no real training involved, it's just that dog's presence makes you feel good. That's kind of why it's just that emotional support. They can't be taken places. There's no real training required for it. But that's what an ESA is. A therapy dog is a dog that is specifically trained to go into like hospitals, treatment centers, nursing homes, schools, that sort of thing. And you are going there volunteering with your dog to comfort others.
Mm-hmm.
These dogs are not allowed anywhere unless they have been invited there to work. They basically have pet status legally. And if, you know, if someone has invited you to go there to work and volunteer, then you may go there. Most places do require a certification. These are the only ones that really have a certification. So like there's no legally recognized certification for service dogs. The legal requirements are you have a disability and your dog has been specifically task trained to assist with that disability. Emotional support animals, you have that doctor or therapist letter. And then therapy dogs are the only ones, at least within the United States, that have, right. You know, someone says you need a certification to go volunteer there, you have to have a certification.
Right.
So.
Well, let's start off with some of the questions that came in, and I'm sure that they'll lead us to, you know, many conversations.
Yeah.
Amy in Utah says, can any animal be a therapy animal?
So a therapy animal, you know, it depends on the organization. There's an organization that I worked for a while that they had mini horses. They had a therapy tortoise that she would wear these little dresses that they'd put up, like hike it up over the shell and like take her in places. So like therapy animals, typically they can be, again, because it's kind of a situation where you're being invited to be there. It depends on, you know, what does the location say, you know, what, you know, so like you can have therapy horses, but you're going to be limited as to where you can go with horse, you know? But yeah, with therapy animals, pretty much anything can be a therapy animal. As far as that certification goes, it more depends on the organization, what types of animals they're willing to certify. But yeah, therapy animals can be pretty much anything.
Anna in North Carolina says, are service animals in training considered service animals under the ADA?
No. So service animals in training are covered specifically under state law. So you have to look up what is your individual state's law.
Okay.
And legally speaking, it's not a service animal in training until you have started working on training tasks.
Okay.
If you haven't started training a task, it's just a dog that's in training.
Okay.
So like in the state of Utah here, service animals in training have the same public access rights as someone who has a fully trained service dog. So like, you know, as long as they meet kind of that minimum behavioral standard of what you want in non-pet friendly places, we're working on making sure that they can task and behave appropriately in those places. We can take service animals in training out into non-pet friendly places. Some states like they don't recognize a service animal in training. And so you kind of, if you're going to go somewhere non-pet friendly, you have to have permission, you know, call in advance sort of thing.
So that's
what it really just depends on the state. And I've seen some states that have kind of weird laws, like some states you can't just own or train by yourself. You have to be training with a company.
Right.
Some states they require like that you have, I don't know if this is still, this has been a long time since I heard this, but I had some clients I worked with in Massachusetts that they said that, they required service dogs in training to be in like red or yellow vests. I don't know if that's changed, cause this has been probably like 6 or 7 years ago, but, some states had like, you have to have photo ID declaring you as the trainer. So like there's all sorts of stuff that can be different state to state.
Okay.
But yeah. So that's very dependent on each individual state.
So Beth in Georgia wants to know, can service animals be any breed of dog?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, as long as they have the right temperament and the right personality. Since we specialize in owner training, we have a pretty wide variety of breeds within our program. Typically kind of your big three that by and large, they tend to be your highest chances of having success are golden retrievers, labs, and standard poodles, of which English lion golden retrievers are my top pick by and large always. We just tend to have the most success with them. They tend to just naturally
have
the personality that you want. Yeah. And like, it's kind of funny. I mean, we can have a golden retriever from like a really amazing breeder and like, we're pretty much guaranteed that they're going to work. Like we see really awful backyard breeders that honestly don't know what they're doing. And they're still putting out golden retrievers with the temperament that we want, because that's just what the breed is. I mean, there are definitely breeds that by and large are strongly recommended to avoid. Because there
would some of those be, that would be good to know.
So like huskies and most Arctic breeds very rarely ever make good service dogs, because they tend to naturally be more independent, more aloof, more cat-like. They're not as sensitive to their owners.
Okay.
You know, they typically want to go more do their own thing, which is kind of the opposite that you really want in a service dog. Yeah. Like a lot of different shepherds very rarely make good service dogs. So like, you know, most people they're like, oh, German Shepherd is a working dog. They very rarely make good service dogs. Because they, you know, for one, they tend to be significantly higher energy than most disabled individuals can handle and keep up with. But they also, they tend to be very sensitive to their owners in that like, they kind of do like, oh, you're not doing well. What can I do to fix it? Who's causing the issues? And they a lot of times become reactive out in public because they focus outward on how can I help you? Whereas like, you know, your typical golden retriever and lab and that sort of thing, you know, if they're like, oh, you're having a problem, here I am. What do you need from me? And they're more like in your face sort of thing. So they have higher chances of like developing those natural alerts to different disabilities, that sort of thing. You know, we typically recommend shepherds and herding breeds and guarding breeds in general. You know, especially with psychiatric stuff, your chance of these breeds kind of developing, you know, those kind of behavioral issues with psychiatric stuff. If you start panicking in public, like those dogs are going to feed off of you.
Right.
You know, I mean, it can work. We have like a herding breed mix. That's an autism dog and she's a rock star.
Okay.
So it can work out, but I mean, I'd say the majority of people in our program who have tried to do like a shepherd or a herding breed for psychiatric service, they've ended up failing. Like it's just something that they struggle with. Guarding breeds. Like if you get a breed that's, you know, that's, they were bred to guard and they start guarding in public.
Like a government picture.
Yeah. Like, yep. You know, you can't be upset with a guarding breed for guarding. And if they display any kind of guarding, you know, anything that can be perceived as aggression by the general public, they can require you to remove your dog.
Right.
You know, so like your dog can't be behaving that way. And if you pick a breed that's prone to those behaviors and they display those behaviors, you can't really be upset. You know, so there's definitely breeds that it's not recommended. They can work out, you know, you can find unicorns within those breeds that are not breed standard and are abnormal for the breed. But yeah. So, I mean, any, you know, I mean, I had one of the first dogs that I trained with my, business specifically, and he was a complete rock star. Was like, he was a shih tzu, and like she called me and told me, she's like, I have a shih tzu I want to train as a service dog. I'm like, are you serious? Like, okay. And I went and I temperament tested him, and he had an amazing personality. She was actually a professor at a college, and we did training so that he could go and just hang out under her desk while she was teaching and kind of, you know, come and alert her if she need, you know, and go back. And he was a rock star. He was amazing. And I never would have guessed in a million years that a shih tzu would be a good service dog.
But unicorns do exist.
Yeah, he was total unicorn. Yeah. And he was awesome. But
I have a question here from Bree in Utah. She says, my dog is 4.5 years of age. Is she too old to be trained now as a service dog?
So Not necessarily. It is pretty strongly recommended against ever doing a dog that is over three. And the reason is more because the training process to fully train a service dog, on average, can take like a year and a half to 2 years. You know, if your dog has already had a ton of training and a ton of work and has a really good foundation, that training process can sometimes go faster, but like a year and a half to 2 years of work is pretty typical. That's what you can expect. And so like, if you start a dog at four and a half and it takes 2 years to train, well, now you have a dog, you know, at six and a half, you know, that's now fully trained. And then most dogs, you expect them to retire anytime between the age of 8 to 10. So you have a dog that potentially is only going to work as a fully trained service dog for you for like a year and a half before you have to retire it and start looking at replacing a dog. So like that drastically decreases that working life of your dog. Whereas, you know, if you start out with a much younger dog or even a puppy, like, you know, if that dog's done training by the time it's between a year and a half to 2 years old, like you have a really good long working life out of your dog before you even have to consider looking into training a new prospect.
And I think we talked, you know, before the show started about the life of a service dog. And some people, some people have this belief that it's for the dog's entire life, but it's not. It's for a period of time because they retire.
Yeah, I mean, some dogs, like if they're really healthy and they're going really strong, you know, I mean, I've never heard of a dog work past, I think the oldest one I heard of was like 12, you know, but this was a dog that lived to be like 16 or 17. This dog lived to be very old. So, you know, I mean, typically you retire them, you know, several years before.
And then they become your pet. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know, so some, there are service dog organizations out there. So like if you get a fully trained dog from an organization, a lot of them will actually not allow you to have any other animals in your house at all. So if you retire your service dog and you want to replace it through them, they have homes that the dog is then retired to, and then you get a new dog, which would crush me. I could never do that. I'm like, that has to be so hard. But like seeing eye dogs, like they don't want anything of this dog learning bad behaviors or anything that could mess it up. And so it's like this dog needs to be the only animal in the household. This needs to be their entire life. And then as soon as that dog retires, like you're going to need a new dog the second your dog retires. Wow. And so it needs to be a pretty quick shift.
About that. That would be so hard.
Yeah.
That makes sense, especially in that situation.
So, yeah.
Brandy in California says, can a service animal be allowed to ride in an ambulance with its handler?
It can. Yes. What's hard is that a lot of times it really kind of depends on the situation, because one thing is that like paramedics are So paramedics are not legally required to be responsible for your service dog. So if something happens to you and you're out by yourself, like I've heard of situations where the service dog has just gotten left. I've heard of situations where they took the service dog with them, but it's kind of up to them because like,
depending on
they need to be focused on you, not your dog.
Right.
If they, you know, and so it's like, if there's not enough of them there to be able to handle your dog, like they have to prioritize you. If there is someone with you that can handle your dog and that person can go on the ambulance with you, then I know a lot of situations where the dog was taken with because there was another person that, you know, so the paramedics didn't need to worry about the dog. They could totally focus. So that's a hard one is like, so legally speaking, yes, the dog can be taken on the ambulance,
but
if it's able to go or not, it's kind of situational.
Yeah.
You know?
I have an emergency card in my car that actually says in case of an emergency, please call. And it lists three different people to cover my dog. So
yeah. And that's a great way to handle it. Like that's a really, really good way to handle it.
At least somebody can make a phone call and
Brent
in Utah asks, can a landlord or housing provider ask details about my disability?
No. So because of HIPAA laws, like that's not really any of their business. I know that the FHA recently changed their laws, if I'm remembering correctly, I'm pretty sure that they kind of have to go with the same kind of the same information that general businesses can ask. So is it a service dog required because of a disability? And what is the dog trained to do for you? And then obviously, again, if the dog does anything that, you know, is like, you know, misbehaves in any way, is destructive, is a nuisance barker, they can automatically say like, no, you can't have the dog here. I know that originally, like, the laws were that they could require some kind of proof of disability. I don't know if this is something that's changed, like, just within our state or what it is. I know that they changed somehow recently. I'm not quite as up to date on the housing laws right now.
Well, airlines have recently changed their laws now.
Yeah.
That people can take their emotional support animals. And now I think people took advantage of that. I know here in Denver, we had somebody try and take a peacock on a flight, and that made the news. And I've seen many pigs and rabbits, and somebody had a snake one time.
Yeah. Well, like, I believe the housing laws, I'm pretty sure, changed last year. And then the airline laws changed in January of this year.
Do you think that happened? Do you think it was because people were taking advantage?
I think it was massive abuse of the system. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you have the issue that people can just get online and just pay for a certification, you know, that legally is kind of meaningless fluff, you know, like, and then just kind of take the animal
out there that give you documentation. How is that even legal?
Yeah, that's a good question. Cause I mean, it causes a lot of problems. Cause like, and we tell people, like, if you go and buy yourself a certification, it's legally meaningless fluff. Right. Like, it's a cute little card or a cute little piece of paper. It does not make your dog a service dog. Like, I have a friend that, just to kind of joke, to show like how much of a joke these organizations are that do this. She has a certified blue whale as her service animal that they went ahead and certified. And like, I know another person that she has a certified service Nutella. She got it like a vest and goes out and takes pictures of her certified service Nutella. That's how much of a joke these organizations are. They don't care. They're not paying attention to if, you know, this is legal or not. They just want money. Yeah, pretty much.
Christian in Utah says, do service animals have to wear a vest or a patch or a special harness identifying them as a service animal?
So, according to the ADA, no. If someone doesn't feel like labeling their service dog, they don't have to. Again, businesses can ask the two legal questions. Is it a service dog required for disability? What is the dog trained to do? But like, you know, if you're in a situation where it's like, well, I just have to stop really quick and run in and run out, like, having to gear up your dog can be kind of a pain in the butt. So like, more than anything, having your dog labeled is a courtesy. It can be some protection for you, because like, if someone comes up and starts massively harassing your dog, you know, sometimes they can kind of get away with it because, well, I didn't know that it was a service dog. Had I known it was a service dog, I never would have done that. Whereas if the dog is very clearly labeled and then they come up and they're harassing your dog, because interfering with a service dog and distracting a service dog in any way is illegal.
Right.
You know,
not understand that.
So it's like, it is illegal. And if your dog is clearly labeled as a service dog, it's a lot easier to be like, hey, don't do that. What you're doing is illegal. You know, you can see that it's a service dog, where if it wasn't labeled, like, you know, it's a long time. Yeah. So I mean, it's more of a courtesy and that sort of thing to label your dog as a service dog. It's not legally required though.
Okay.
Some state laws, again, like for service dogs in training, if they say this service dog in training has to be labeled, they can require that. But yeah, so.
David in Colorado says, what's the process of getting a dog certified to be a therapy dog?
So a lot of it is looking into what organization you want to go through. Most therapy dog organizations, your dog has to be at least a year to a year and a half before they'll certify them. There are some organizations that are going to be more local to where, so like one of the big organizations that's where I'm at in Utah is Intermountain Therapy Dogs. They are only recognized where there are Intermountain hospital facilities. But that's a really, really popular one to go through here. And it's basically just finding out what are their requirements. A lot of times they'll have like handbooks and all this different information on like what you need to do to go and test through them, what a test looks like. Sometimes they'll have their own training program, or they'll have trainers that they recommend that you can go through. And then once your dog is ready, you would just go and test through them. And then there are nationally recognized organizations, and there are also internationally recognized organizations. So like there's International Therapy Dogs,
right?
And there's Pet Partners is an internationally recognized organization. A lot of them, they're going to have very similar standards, but there are some that have, there are going to be differences in requirements and what they want to see, So I know like a lot of organizations, like your dog either has to have a body harness or a basic flat collar. Anything else, like if your dog can't pass the test, then you can't. I know that Pet Partners typically does allow like a head collar, as long as there's no metal anywhere on it.
Okay.
But a lot of those standards and requirements, it depends on the organization that you want to go through.
So Elena in Colorado asked, can a person bring their service animal to them as they go through a salad bar or other self-service food lines?
So this is a really hard one. I've actually had a lot of clients that we have discussed this with recently. I've talked to like, disability law advocates and people who are, like lawyers and stuff who specialize in the law. And they all say, yes, legally speaking, like you are supposed to be able to take your dog up with you. Every single restaurant I've ever been to, they will fight it tooth and nail. And they seem to fight it tooth and nail because the health departments fight it tooth and nail. And the health departments are the ones telling them that it's not allowed.
Right.
And so like, this is a struggle because it's like the restaurant has to follow health code. And if the health code is telling them that they will cite them if someone takes a service dog, like that's not on the restaurant, that's on the health department. But educating the health departments and getting them to drop this for whatever reason seems to be a really, really hard one. We typically honestly recommend to our clients who are like, have someone at the table that just sits with your dog while you go get food and then you swap or something like that.
I was gonna say, I usually leave Aspen at the table.
Yeah.
Even if I'm by myself, she'll stay if I give her command to stay while I go. And I have really taken her through a food line yet, but that's a great question.
I have a friend that like we've gone out to a few places, and like since she can't take her dog up, like we need to be able to trust her dog to stay at the table, and she takes me up as her service person. It's like restaurants, they don't complain if your dog is good and calm and staying under the table while you go up, but like restaurants will fight it. And I feel like that's one that's not the restaurant's fault. That's the health department's fault. And kind of figuring out how to fix that is like a whole different ball game. So,
it is, it gets complicated.
Yeah. I tell people like, don't blame the restaurants on that because every single one will tell you that the health department has specifically told them that they will cite them for service dogs going up. And that is not the restaurant's fault.
Yeah. And if you can do someplace that has outdoor seating, that helps as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eric in California says, can my landlord place a weight or breed restriction on my emotional support animal?
So this one gets a lot more complicated. I've heard a lot of arguments for this one, and it goes back and forth. I've heard some people say, no, absolutely they can't under any circumstances. I've heard other people say that like if they have insurance that covers them, and like that the insurance does not cover if the insurance does not cover specific breeds or that sort of thing, very rarely does an insurance have a weight limit. Putting a weight limit on a dog, the chances of a apartment complex being able to enforce that are pretty slim. The breed one is the one that's more argued, and I've heard both sides of it.
Yeah. Here in Colorado.
Yeah. Some people, so a lot of times, like when I hear stuff like that, I usually honestly recommend, like, so we have the Disability Law Center here in Utah, and I usually recommend, like, go talk to those guys. They're going to know a lot better, because it really does. I'm like, I hear back and forth on that one all the time of like, if the landlords are like, well, our insurance absolutely does not cover these breeds, therefore we cannot have them on the property. And, you know, and that creates like, you know, so they say like, basically if there's an undue burden. So like if a landlord is having to go out of their way to call their insurance and try and get a special accommodation for this one dog, does that qualify as an undue burden? And that's where it comes is like, I've heard some people be like, no, that's not an undue burden. It's a really easy thing to go and do. And other people are like, no, that is an undue burden. Why should they have to do that? And so that's where it gets kind of foggy is like, okay, I don't know on that one.
Well, so, I know we kind of talked about this one before. This is Ernie in California. And he says, who can write an ESA letter for me? And I think, as you said, it needs to be, you know, a therapist.
Therapist, psychiatrist. So for our company, we do require that they have to have someone who has been treating them for, you know, ideally for at least a few months. Like we're very careful to try and make sure that we're not training fake service dogs. We usually ask, we want someone who has been treating you, who is familiar with your disability and is willing to just write us a letter saying that they have diagnosed you with a disability. And I tell them, it doesn't need to tell us what the disability is. I mean, the more we know about your disability, then the more that we will know how to help you. Your relationship with a service dog organization is very different than, you know, your relationship with a business that has no right to know. You know, but we, you know, we're like HIPAA laws. If you don't want to tell us the exact diagnosis that you have, you don't have to. We just need to see there's been a diagnosis, that someone is willing to back you, that were ever to go to court, that you have, you have a mental health professional who would be willing to be like, oh yeah, I diagnosed that person. They absolutely have this disability.
And that's where these illegal sites online, I had somebody test it out and they spent 10 minutes with a so-called therapist who then gave them a diagnosis and wrote a letter.
Yeah. And that's where I'm like, okay, would this person be willing to go to court for you?
Right. Because that's a great question for them to ask.
Yeah. Cause it's like, you know, and I've talked to people that like they've had situations where they've been accused of having a fake service dog to the point of it going to court. And it's like, well, I've got all these doctors that are willing to back me up.
Right.
And they're willing to stay in a court of law. Yes, I've diagnosed this person with this disability. And here's all of the training that I've put into my dog. And you know, I have training logs or all these different things. And it's like, oh, you have all this stuff and it's, you know, it's thrown out. And then you can counter sue, you know, for lawyer fees and whatever else hardships that this person caused you that led to going to court, you know. And so,
Those fake letters online are not going to do that for you.
No, they're not. And so we try to make sure that, you know, we're protected as much as possible. Cause like I've also heard of service dog companies getting in trouble for training fake service dogs. So it's like, we don't want to get in trouble for that. We want to make sure our clients are fully legally protected.
Fake service dogs. What does that mean?
What? Sorry, say that again.
Training fake service dogs.
So training a service dog for someone that does not have a disability and telling and like basically telling them this dog is certified as a service dog for an individual that does not have a disability and does not have the legal right to have a service dog.
Okay. Gary in Colorado asked, can hotels assign designated rooms for guests with service animals out of consideration for other guests?
So that's a harder one. I mean,
I think
if they want to have specific rooms that they kind of do, well, these are the ones we usually have people with service dogs go to, they can. But if those rooms are full, they still have to accommodate.
Give you a room. Right.
They can't just say, well, our service dog rooms are full. They still have to accommodate you.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, if they want to technically have some rooms that are like, well, these are the service dog rooms, I don't see how that would be illegal. But again,
hotels I've stayed in have done that and they've just made them first floor rooms,
which is typically for disabled individuals in general.
It's easy for you to go in and out then instead of having to take the elevator or stairs and go somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of times they do like hotels in general will have specifically designated rooms for individuals with disabilities, just in general, to make things easier. So like having those designated rooms, it's not like that's fine. They just still, if those rooms are full, they have space in the hotel, they still have to make the accommodation.
Okay. Joe in Florida says, how long have therapy dogs been around? I thought that was a great question.
Gosh. I actually have no idea. A very, very, very long time. I don't think they've been around as long as service dogs have been.
So service dogs, you think, started first?
Service dogs, the very first service dog organization, if I remember correctly, it was a C&I dog organization. I think it was called the C&I. They're still around. They still exist today. Right. If I remember right, they started in like the 1920s or the 1930s.
Wow.
Okay. I'm pretty sure they've been around close to, if not 100 years.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure service dogs have been a thing longer than therapy dogs. Exactly. Yeah. When
and
therapy
it's just now the different services that they provide. We were talking, and I think this is really interesting for you to share, about how people now are getting dogs trained for people who have gluten intolerance.
Yeah. So, so I've got a friend that she had, so her dog is 8 now. She got her as a 10-week-old puppy. When she got this dog, Naga was the 6th service dog in the United States trained for gluten detection. So it was still very, very, very new. And in general, I mean, as far as service dogs go, gluten detection is still very, very new.
Right.
But like, if I remember right, she was the 6th gluten detection dog in the United States. I think she was the third trained within the United States though. So Naga was like really, really, really new. And it is starting to pick up more. People are starting to learn more about it because it is a very different, unique type of scent training. Most scents when you do scent training, whether it's for like a severe allergen detection or drug detection or bomb detection or whatever else, it's every single time this dog smells this smell, it needs to hit on it and say, hey, that smell is there. Every single time. That's your goal, you know, search and rescue dogs, all these sort of things. And all of these tend to be kind of stronger smells. Most smells, what you get is the smell rises. And I guess gluten tends to sink. It's a harder smell to detect in general. But we also live in such a massively gluten saturated environment.
Right.
I mean, like, were this dog to be alerting every single time, they would alert on almost every single person that you passed, you know, like the dog would
be
alerting.
And share the restaurant story because that was, I don't think that's something people would normally.
So basically though, with gluten detection, you have to train the dog to do a controlled alert where they only alert when asked for it, which is a harder thing to do in general. Like, so I have Rebecca who owns Naga. She, if we get people who are interested, she is the one who does the gluten detection portion. I'm like, I know how to do other kinds of scent training. I don't know how to do that controlled alert. It's more specialized. But she, and she said like since having Naga, she gets sick. I think she said like 75% less. Like the amount
That's
of things
amazing.
That Naga hits on that she never would have guessed. Like she goes into stores and the number of things that are labeled as being gluten-free and then Naga hits on it. It's like, no, it's not,
oh, wow.
You know, is crazy. But like, I know she said, so she went to Red Lobster and I guess Red Lobster like is usually really, really good and have quite a few things that are gluten-free and gluten-friendly. And they're usually pretty good about it and usually work pretty hard to prevent cross-contamination and stuff. So typically she can eat there, you know. It's always going to, for her, it's like, she's like, it's a hit or a miss. If I'm going to go to a restaurant, even if they, you know, take a ton of precautions, it's a gamble.
You just don't know.
You just don't know. So you hope it'll be good, but you just don't know. But she said that, you know, she got her plate and Naga checks her plate and she's like, oh yeah, it's clear. You're good. And then she asks her to check her silverware and she hits on the silverware and says the silverware is contaminated. And what they found out is kind of what like the server had just not really been thinking. He had grabbed like their rolls and put it in the basket and then he grabbed the silverware. And he had that cross contamination. And like, you know, and like with celiac disease, like you can be so overwhelmingly sensitive that like, yeah, that's just that little bit can make you very, very sick.
Can make you very, very sick.
So
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, gluten detection, it's still very new. Finding trainers that know how to do it, know how to do it properly. You know, and that sort of thing can be hard because it is still pretty new. But I mean, it's becoming more popular. More people are learning how to do it. Like it's a pretty cool thing and it's needed. So,
Karen in California asks, can therapy dogs ease autism symptoms?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of it is going to depend on the individual with autism, if they have a lot of sensory processing. So like, I worked with someone that like their child could not stand the feeling of anything soft and fluffy. Like, did I'm so like a service dog or a therapy dog or whatever, like realistically, that's not a great option because the child like doesn't want the dog anywhere near him. You know, so, I mean, it depends, but I mean, like, you know, in other situations, absolutely. Like, you know, with autism, a lot of times just just having the dog come and hang out with them and comfort them. You know, we've seen a lot of things like these kids open up in ways to a dog and connect with a dog in a way that they, you know, their disability just prevents them from doing with a person. Mm-hmm. And being, you know, suddenly like playing with the dog and wanting to talk to the dog and throw the ball for the dog and do all these interaction things, you know, that they don't do in other situations. And so, you know, and again, that's a reason why, service dogs for autism in general is becoming a lot more popular, you know, because then you can also train tasks like different grounding tasks or pressure therapy, you know, if they're having meltdowns, or, you know, we have some clients that their kids tend to just take off and be gone. And so training the dog, how to be able to go find those kids. You know, one thing with this is like, so a really popular task for a long time was training an anchor sit, where basically the dog, if the kid tried to move, the dog would just sit and anchor themselves and refuse to move. I hate this task. It is an incredibly dangerous task. You know, no amount of training is ever going to stop a dog from being a dog, and tethering a dog to a child,
it's risky.
That alone is not smart, you know, and I've seen the worst of what can happen with that, of a dog getting overexcited and barely hitting the end of the leash. And it took the little girl down. She landed on a curb. She ruptured her spleen and had to be life flighted to the nearest children's hospital. And so I'm like, I'm not willing to touch that task. But you also get like, if a kid runs hard enough and they're tethered to that dog, they can do physical damage to the dog.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, that's been a really popular task to train for autism dogs. I won't do it. I'm not willing to, but it's like, we can train the dog to go and find your child, you know, get you right to your child. We can train the dog to kind of go and run and do a block behavior. And so if your child is running, kind of run and get in front of them and kind of wrangle them back in, sort of thing.
Now, so, I mean, what about any adults with autism? Because I'm finding that a lot of people aren't getting diagnosed at times until they're in their, you know, 18, 19, 20, and 20s. Yeah. And now they're wanting to get a service dog. So do you work with young adults as well?
Yeah. So the person I mentioned that has an Aussie, that's an autism dog, she's in her 20s.
Okay.
And so the dog still does, you know, like, she has massive struggles with crowds. Mm-hmm. So we've trained the dog to do kind of a crowd control, which basically the dog circles around her to kind of just get people to move out a little bit farther and give her a little bit more space if she's getting sensory overwhelmed.
Okay.
The dog, we train kind of an alert behavior. So if she starts doing stimming or things like that, the dog will kind of alert and interrupt it a little bit. The dog does pressure therapy. The dog does different grounding behaviors to help de-escalate her.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, she's an adult. She handles things a lot better than she did as a child, but she still has a lot of those symptoms. And we have a client that, you know, he's severe on the autism spectrum. He's going to be living at home. You know, he's non-speech, you know, going to be in diapers for life. And that dog, like, he's the one that's trained to run and wrangle him in. If he just takes off, he's
okay.
Trained, you know, he's being trained to do like get help. So if he starts crying or anything, that the dog can run in and find one of his parents and bring him back. So there's still a few different things that, that we've trained there as well. Like, go and get, you know, if there's like a huge massive accident, like, he can go and get a cleanup bag while the parents take care of their son.
Wow.
You know, so there's, you know, and again, de-escalation type tasks. So there's still quite a few things that you can train depending on where they're at on the spectrum, you know, at any age. So,
Kimberly in Utah asks, you know, where can service dogs be excluded Now, I've heard that churches can exclude dogs.
So, yeah, because of the separation of church and state, you can, like, churches can legally deny. If they have some sort of event that they're inviting the general public to, then my understanding is they do typically have to allow that. But to their worship sermons and different things like that, if they want to say no, they are allowed to. I know that, like, army bases and stuff like that, the laws involving service dogs are actually very different.
Okay. About that. Yeah.
Which I only know that because we've had some clients that lived on an army base and they're the ones who told us, like, the laws are different and they handle things different. And, like, what they recognize as a service dog versus what they don't recognize as a service dog is different, which back then I know that they viewed psychiatric service dogs as ESAs, which I think that's finally changed within the military. But there were some differences there apparently. And so, like, you know, so I learned that. And then anything again, if it's a health or safety issue. So, like, you can go to the pool with your dog, but your dog cannot get into the water.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know we have a wild animal kingdom sanctuary here, and they don't allow any dogs, and it's because of the animals. It would.
Yeah. If it's like an open air thing and that they can interact. Yeah.
It could cause difficulties with some of the wild animals.
Yeah. Well, and there's diseases that they can kind of pass to each other.
Yeah.
Like I know, like, at our zoo here in Utah, there are specific areas that the dogs cannot go to.
Yes,
they have access to the majority of the park.
Yeah, this here too. They have areas that they allow the dogs to go. Mm-hmm. They actually give you a map when you go in if you have your dog, and they say, and these are the areas to avoid.
Yeah, and like, and some of them, so like, it's because the amount of stress that it causes certain animals, it's like, that's not okay.
No, it's not okay.
And I know, so like at our zoo, they have some employees that they will bring dogs in to work with those animals, like that these dogs are really trained and really calm. And so for years, like their Asian Highlands area, they said dogs can't go up there. And this year they finally, they're like, yeah, we've worked with the tigers and the different animals up there enough that they're really good. And you can go there now. And I'm like, that's awesome. But yeah. So.
Well, I still have 2 pages of questions. We're not going to get to them all. So I'm definitely going to need to have you come back, Molly. I want to make sure that people know how to reach you, where you're located, get your website, your phone number, where they can call and get more information about everything that you're offering.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're in Orem, Utah. My website, it's mollydogs.com. It's spelled M-O-L-L-I. My name gets spelled wrong far too often.
Yeah, same with me.
And then typically email is usually what's going to work really well.
Okay.
And it's mollydogs@yahoo.com.
Okay. And you do training with people who come in with their dogs already.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're kind of working on doing remote training a little bit. It's not something we've done a ton of. It's still very new to us.
How does that work?
So basically kind of, we try and set up sessions so that, people, So, I mean, we try to do video calls largely.
Okay.
And like, if we need them to go out in public, we try and set it up. So like, okay, you need to have someone there that can have your phone and we need to be able to watch and we'll tell you what we need you to do. And, you know, and we can try and demonstrate things with our own dogs to kind of show you, this is what I want you to do. So, I mean, it's still kind of experimental for us. We're still kind of working on figuring out, you know, for people that are farther away from us. Mostly we, you know, ideally if people can come to us, that's definitely what we're most familiar with, but yeah, it's
okay.
It's that's
well,
what we
thank
do.
You so much for being here today. I mean, again, just so much information and, lots of great questions and lots of information. So I appreciate it. Would welcome you back anytime.
Absolutely.
And, definitely next time I'm in Utah, I will give you a ring and let you know I'm there so that we can connect as well.
Yeah, get in touch.
Thank you so much, Molly.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Next week, our guest is going to be Gina Morgan, and Gina's going to talk about raising a spirited child. spirited child, which requires a lot of patience. Gina is raising several spirited children in her family and has a lot of great experience and information to share regarding that. So I've known Gina for a long time. It'll be a wonderful opportunity for those who want to listen in. My saying this week comes from a book I've been reading, The Diary of a Young Girl, written by Anne Frank. I think this was probably required reading when I was in high school. I was not the best high school student, so I didn't read it. But recently reading it, I came across this saying, think of all the beauty still left around you and be happy. And considering what she went through, and to be able to have that kind of outlook on the world just really warmed my heart. So thank you all for being here today. I will see you next week, Thursday, 12 Mountain Time. Every voice matters. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, just reach out and let me know. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.